and you are listening to Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Joining us now in studio is Bruce Lerow. He is a longtime teacher in a variety of settings. He's also author of Power in Eden, The Emergence of Gender Hierarchies in the Ancient World. The book describes how male dominance and female subordination emerged in ancient societies and how gender hierarchies were perpetuated over time. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So how did you get interested in gender stratification in the ancient world?
Well, at first, I was, of course, interested in the origins of class stratification. And then I began to wonder about the relationship between class stratification and gender stratification. And I had questions about which came first. And I studied Engel's book, The Origin of Private Property, the Family, and the State. And I wanted to know more about not just what he thought, but what scholars had come up with over the last 120 years or so about the same questions he raised. So that catapulted my explorations.
Well, Engels and Marx, they described early forms of social organization as primitive communism. Tell us what that means.
Well, the way I see it, I think what they were talking about is it's about natural resources and having access to natural resources and complete access to the tools you use to work on the resources and control over the power settings. In other words, the political settings in which decisions are made. And from what anthropologists and archaeologists say now, Marx was very right about that.
Yeah, I mean, you refer to early hunting-gathering and simple horticultural societies, and this is a long time ago, as egalitarian. And that term suggests that male dominance at least wasn't institutionalized in those societies. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And you know, the problem with the word egalitarian is sometimes people think of the word as, oh, that means everybody is equal in all respects. And there's a good distinction to be made between privilege and power on the one hand and influence and prestige on the other. And even in egalitarian societies, men and women, there are differences in terms of influence. Like influence means that you can move people to do things without any coercion. You can move them by force of example, by being a good speaker. Prestige means the esteem with which your job is held. So even within egalitarian societies, there are differences between people in terms of privilege and between influence and prestige. Now, one of the things that I found that I was absolutely fascinated by, and this is the work of a woman named Peggy Reeves Sandey.
Anthropologist, still living, I understand.
Right. Peggy Reeves Sandey wrote a book around 1981 called Female Power and Male Dominance. And what she did was she did a cross-cultural study of 150 tribal societies. And what she found was that even within egalitarian societies, when the societies used large game as opposed to small game, they tended to have elements of male dominance. When the work patterns were segregated as opposed to integrated, there would be more inclination of male dominance. When people had scarce resources and they had to move, that was another indication of male dominance. So, in other words, there were certain conditions, even in egalitarian societies, in which the seeds of what she calls mythological male dominance were planted. So big game as opposed to small game, food abundance versus food scarcity, integrated work patterns versus segregated work patterns, all these things will influence the beginnings of male dominance. It's not institutionalized, but it's what she calls mythological. I've changed it to informal male dominance because she uses the word mythological in a pejorative way.
So is it fair to say then that the greater the stress on a society, and so stress and sort of unequal or equal division of labor, that those two factors determine in large part whether there is some sort of informal male dominance happening?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And again, the greater the stress, the greater the likelihood of informal male dominance.
Right.
And the more work patterns are segregated, then the more, again, informal male dominance comes to play. Let's talk about sort of the segregation of work, both out in perhaps hunting or gathering or doing horticultural work and child rearing. Is there sort of a logical connection between, well, yeah, in fact, if men don't participate with these things equally as women, they are more likely to assert themselves in certain ways?
Yeah, I think, for example, if you take the classical division, if you have men doing big game hunting and women doing the gathering, the men are often away for long periods of time, and so they're not around to do child-rearing practices. If, on the other hand, there's a rise in population, there's a decline in resources, then what happens is these hunting and gathering societies switch off from large game to hunting small game. Once those societies begin hunting small game, the whole nuclear family hunts the game together. And so you have integrated work patterns, and that bodes better for women because they're not only working together in the hunt, but the men are around to help raise the kids.
What about stresses on society? You mentioned food scarcity, resource depletion, overpopulation, and or crowding. What about those situations might make male members of society more dominant, in a sense, over female members?
Well, this is an interesting problem. Peggy Reeves-Sandé doesn't really give an explanation as to why when there's stressful circumstances, it leads more to male dominance. She just notes it. I know from doing research for another chapter of my book, the research I've done shows that men and women handle stress differently. And basically, men are more likely to take out stress on women under these conditions, and women are just better handling the stress in a group context. She doesn't make that argument, but that's what I found from my own research in other places.
And what period of time are we talking about? I'm assuming it's before the Common Era. When were these societies?
The whole stretch of my book goes from about 12,000 BCE, which is before Common Era, which is the very end of the Upper Paleolithic. Those are hunting and gathering societies. Then about 8,000 BCE, you get the first horticulture societies. Then you get agricultural state civilizations, about 3,000 BCE. And then you get commercial farming, which is the Axial Iron Age, which is somewhere around 600 to 400 BCE. So these are long stretches of time. And this process of male dominance is a very slow process, and it really happens over thousands of years.
Bruce Lero, he is author of the book Power in Eden, The Emergence of Gender Hierarchies in the Ancient World, published last year by Trafford Press. We're happy he joins us today in studio. Well, you're talking about informal male dominance in these early hunting, gathering, and simple horticultural societies, and you've also referred to institutionalized male dominance. What are the principal differences between institutionalized and informal?
Institutionalized male dominance is where a few men basically control the infrastructure of society, the structure, and the superstructure of society. Informal male dominance is where men and women, men have influence and prestige over women, but they don't have privilege and power. And so informal male dominance, once it comes into being, it doesn't necessarily stay for very long, because as ecological and demographic changes occur and people move, conditions get better, it reverts back to minimal male dominance. So it's a more kind of an episodic process, whereas institutionalized male dominance begins with complex horticulture societies, and that's where you get the beginnings of hierarchy. You get a hierarchy of chiefs at the top, district managers in the middle, and then commoners, who are usually planters and artisans, at the bottom. Once that process gets in place and those hierarchies are grounded, then it makes it very difficult to change. And in those cases, a few men at the top more or less monopolize the technology, the economic resources, and the political structure. So it's a much more long-lasting setup.
There's also something to be said, which is in your book, about the way women in societies that have informal male dominance, the way in which they perceive men who are either trying to exert their perhaps influence over them. Talk about that.
Okay. This is very interesting because how Peggy Reeves defines informal male dominance says that men do have some privilege, some prestige and influence, but the women don't internalize that. In fact, they sort of make fun of the men. They laugh. They really don't believe that men have more power. And it's only through the process of this stage theory that I've developed where you can see the process where women eventually come to believe that they are inferior. Which is, of course, a much deeper process and a much harder process to reverse. But that was not true of informal male dominance.
To what extent, you referred to mythology earlier on, to what extent are gender relations, say, in the societies we've been talking about, reflected in the myths of these societies?
That's a very, very interesting question. What I found is that, for example, if you look at hunting and gathering societies and early horticulture societies, the types of sacred presences are earth spirits and ancestors. And usually, if you look at the relationships between the earth spirits and the ancestors, and you sort of examine their spiritual relationships from a political point of view, they actually reflect the material relations that exist in the society. So the way the earth spirits treat each other, the way the ancestor spirits treat each other, is very close politically and economically to how people in the material culture treat each other. When you get to agricultural state civilizations, you get gods and goddesses. And what happens is that the gods and goddesses begin to reflect the alienation that people feel in their material life. In other words, in agricultural state civilizations, you've got social castes. So in the mythologies and in the myths, what you begin to see is instead of everybody participating in the rituals, instead of everybody participating in the mythological stories, you begin to see that the gods and goddesses are doing most of the work. And so the people on Earth, because they're alienated in their work life, they become only helpers to the spiritual process. So they're sort of alienated in the spiritual world just as they're alienated in the material world. So this was one of my main interests in looking at the social superstructure in terms of understanding how it reflected material conditions.
What about the question of the nature of the process of institutionalized female subordination? So here we get into really institutionalized male domination, institutionalized female subordination in ancient times. To what degree was it a very sudden process, or to what degree was it sort of a gradual process over time?
Well, when I first started to study this material, I thought that what I was going to find was that it was a sudden process. And indeed, there are people that have made an argument that these tribal societies were essentially peaceful. And then one day some herders from the north came down with their warrior ways, and they transformed societies, and then male dominance became prevalent from that point on. What I've discovered is that it's much more complicated than that. And what I've done is I've synthesized the work of, I would say, Lev Vygotsky, who was a great Marxist psychologist, and Wilhelm Reich, and I've developed a five-stage theory as to how this has happened. I'll just give you the stages first, and then I can describe what each one means. The first stage is called enmeshment, and you can picture this in the form of like a cycle. Enmeshment is more or less the first stage. The second stage is coercion. The third stage is legitimization. The fourth stage is internalization. And the fifth stage is collusion. Now, the enmeshment stage is the stage in which men have some power over women, but there are certain social circumstances where that power of men is overridden. So, for example, if you have a district manager in a complex horticulture society that has a higher rank than a commoner woman, and they're meeting at the market to negotiate something or other, if that woman is older than the man, has elderly status, has a great deal of skill in her work, the value of her product is highly praised among the members of their society, and she has very close kinship binds, then in that situation, the male power will be overridden by the female power. Mm-hmm. So enmeshment means, in general, men have more power than women, but in various situational contexts, that can be reversed.
If we move on to coercion, does this mean formal coercion? And if so, I wonder what it requires in terms of institutional resources and structures.
Right. Yeah. Coercion is, you can see coercion really taking place with agricultural state civilizations, because this occurs with the rise of states and cities, and with the rise of states, you get a special military force, and that force can overpower any opposition. So in this case, once male dominance comes into play with states and cities, you have the state backing up the social institutions of male dominance. And, of course, that's a very powerful thing.
And what time in history, again, are we talking
this is
about?
This is about 3000 BCE.
3000 BCE.
Right.
Now, legitimization, and this is, I think, where it kind of gets interesting, because we're talking more about ideology.
Right.
What is legitimization?
Okay, legitimization is where you have social institutions that basically justify what the coercive forces are doing. So in the case of the ancient world, one of the biggest legitimizing institutions was what I call secondary magic, or polytheism and monotheism, which basically explain to people why they're in the place that they're actually in. So once legitimization comes in, coercion is not something that is on the front line anymore. It's still there as a backup, but it's not the primary. Repressor. There's something new. The interesting thing about it is that these legitimizing institutions, they really take a long time. They don't, you know, it takes generations for them to build that up. So, for example, you could see that in the Bronze Age, in the early Bronze Age, you had coercive forces, but the legitimizing forces were not all that powerful. And you had, for example, goddesses were very powerful in the early Bronze Age. Then what you begin to see is, in the middle Bronze Age, the reversal between the men and women starts, between the gods and goddesses starts to happen, and you start to see that the gods take over some of the provinces of the goddesses. Then by the time you get to the late Bronze Age, you've got the gods monopolizing more or less everything. And then the stage is set for the rise of monotheism, in which the goddesses are virtually non-existent. Mm.
Before we get to the last two stages of this five-stage cycle, so what you're saying, for example, with enmeshment, coercion, and legitimization already, are you saying that each one developed over time, and that you could have enmeshment, say, without coercion and legitimization, you could have enmeshment and coercion without legitimization? Is that how it works?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Like, I think to try to keep it as justice to the complexity, what I try to do is say that all five stages are existing in all these societies, but some of them are very weakly developed.
I see.
And then some of them get fleshed out. Then by the time you get to the Axial Iron Age, all of them are working. All five stages are in full bloom.
Okay, so now we have, we've talked about legitimization. Then there's something called internalization.
Right. Now this is the psychological side of this. And this is where, when you have legitimizing institutions, people still have a choice about whether or not they internalize these beliefs. And they digest it and they make it part of their psychology. The internalization part is where women come to believe that they deserve to be in a subordinate position because it's natural, it's inevitable. And then this leads to psychological processes like low self-esteem, lack of assertiveness, self-destructiveness, things like that. And then once those things are in place, of course, the coercion factor doesn't really have to be in front force anymore because people are busy beating themselves
up. It's not necessary.
Right.
The overt force.
And you could apply this to social classes as well, because when working class people feel like they really are inferior, well, then you don't have to have a police force telling people that they can't take this or they can't take that, because they're too repressed to actually go after what they want.
So could the stage of internalization be seen as basically the ultimate success of legitimization structures in society?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Right. And then collusion.
Yeah, now this term I use in a kind of special way, because the word usually is meant to sound like it's something that people go along with. And the way I use the term collusion, I call it the laboring activity that reproduces the social institutions of oppression. So in other words, everyone that goes to work in order to receive a wage is reproducing the very institutions that suppress them. So in one sense, it's understandable that people have to work. But in another sense, if we go with the way Marx talked about what society was, and he said society is not a thing. Society is a collective creative activity. If men and women are both actors and actresses in that collective creative activity, then men and women together are reproducing the conditions of their oppression. So if men and women are going to be able to do anything about those conditions, they have to take some responsibility in their work life for what they're doing. So, for example, when women resist the collusion, where workers resist collusion, they do things like they have strikes, sabotage, walkouts, things like that. So there's opportunities in this collusion phase to do things differently. My major point was to say that people have to take responsibility for their conditions if they're going to be able to change them, and that otherwise what we wind up is simply saying people are victims of circumstance. So I'm trying to walk a fine line between not saying people are victims of circumstance, but neither am I saying that people create their own reality, that there's something in between those two extremes.
And the starkest example of women colluding in female subordination would be what? A woman working in a factory that produces a product that perpetuates male domination?
Right.
Bruce Lero, author of Power in Eden, The Emergence of Gender Hierarchies in the Ancient World. I guess I want to just bring up the issue of big men. There are big men in even simple horticultural societies. So these are societies we talked about before that have sort of informal male dominance, not mm-hmm. institutionalized yet. Quickly, kind of, who were they and under what conditions would their, I guess not powered, but under which conditions would their prestige grow?
Okay. Usually what big men did was they were basically party throwers, and they competed with each other. Like, for example, when they were growing yams or they were growing potatoes, they would compete with each other. And in the process of competing with each other, there was kind of a secondary benefit. They saw themselves as party throwers and as people that were seen by the community as being generous. The thing that they did for society that was very important is that they began to build a surplus of these things so that people had these things when the resources began to run out. But so the interesting thing is that the big men did not have institutionalized power, because when the party was over, the big man lost any power. But there is a connection between what became of big men and what eventually become chiefs. So there's a direct line between a big man who is just simply a party thrower, and then eventually under certain later conditions in the horticultural era, the big man becomes more or less institutionalized into a chief. And then what happens is the chief then has control over the resource base, and then the chief begins to develop some kind of surplus value, and his powers become more institutionalized over the long run.
Let me end this way. We talked earlier about your 5-stage process by which a sort of gradual institutionalized female subordination came to play, and you have written that collusion, the last stage, is actually present in all phases of this process. So enmeshment, coercion, legitimization, and then internalization. What time in history witnessed really the culmination where we got to that internalization phase and subordinated groups like women, for example, were internalizing these structures?
Yeah, I think it's the stage of what's been called the Axial Iron Age. That's the stage where the legitimization forces are in place. And this is, for example, if you used Greek society or Chinese society in the period of about 600 to 400 BCE, you can actually see in the way women were treated, the way women thought about themselves, that they had internalized this process. Earlier, even in Bronze Age civilizations, you don't see that as much. So I would say it's the last period, the Axial Iron Age, is when all these stages are fully in place.
Bruce Lero, for more than the last 15 years, he's been developing courses ranging across such disciplines as sociology, mythology, socio-historical psychology, and political economy. He's a big thinker. Bruce Lero is author of Power in Eden. Thanks so much, Bruce, for joining us.
My pleasure. I had a great time.